Hide your books, everyone. This time we discuss Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. Welcome back to Sophomore Lit. We've had some snow days, but we'll just have to make it up with more days in June. I'm John McCoy, and with me this day is my co-host, Liza Daly. Liza, say hi.
Hi.
Liza and I know each other from back in the early days of the dot-com era when we used to work together on public radio websites, which made no one any money. But these days, Liza has a real career. Would you like to tell them about it?
Sure, John. I'm Chief Technology Officer at Safari Books Online. We provide access to ebooks, so I thought that this particular title would be apropos to discuss.
I want to, in the interest of full disclosure, this podcast is premised around the idea of books that were read in high school and rereading them now, many years later, as adults. I will stipulate I did not read this book for a class, but I did read it when I was in high school. I think I read it a little bit earlier than high school, because back in the 70s, as a little nerd, I really, really tried hard to read all the science fiction I was supposed to read. And so Bradbury was one of those names like Asimov or Heinlein that was sort of inescapable. So I tried to read it, and I remember not being too impressed with it when I was younger. Did you read this book for a class?
I did not read it at all, which in retrospect is surprising. I did see the film, and I did read some Bradbury as a teenager, but for some reason I never got to this.
Well, then it'll be a learning experience for all of us. So a little background on the book. This book was published in 1953. At the time, Bradbury was working in Hollywood as a screenwriter, as well as publishing his own stories. Bradbury himself was born in Waukegan, Illinois in 1920. His family moved back and forth between Illinois and Arizona for many years before arriving in L.A. Bradbury himself loved Hollywood. He was quite starstruck. In his early writings, you find all these notes about which stars he'd seen where, and he was also an amateur magician. He was also an autodidact. He did not go to college, but he did love reading a variety of writers, mostly the classics, but he was also attracted to Edgar Rice Burroughs. He wrote a unofficial fan novel about the characters from the John Carter books. So there's a long history of fan novels out there. And he also read a lot of poetry. And I think if you read any Bradbury, that doesn't come as any surprise. Did you know anything about Bradbury's background, or is this the sort of thing that you don't care about?
My edition had a lot of both fore and back matter, and it included some things about his life and also a kind of chronology of the writing of the book. So I mostly knew of him as this curmudgeon when he was very old that he didn't... Is he the one who never flew anywhere?
Maybe. That sounds like him. I don't know that story. I do know that he was a kind of a grumpy old man. But it seems like all the science fiction writers from that era were, you know, him and Asimov and certainly Ellison, who is still with us. Bradbury is an interesting science fiction writer in that he famously resisted the label of science fiction writer, even though almost all of his early work was published in science fiction magazines. He liked to call himself a fantasy writer. He said he also was quite reactionary. There was a famous quote by him where he said, "People ask me to predict the future when all I want to do is prevent it." And I think that you read this book, you can see a lot of sort of reactionary, I wouldn't say politics, but more reactionary thinking. He wrote this book, interestingly enough, on a typewriter that he rented at the UCLA Powell Library. And in those days, you rented typewriters by the hour, and he wrote it originally as a short story. And then was encouraged to expand it into a novel, which he did. But it is a very short novel. And whether or not there's enough story here to warrant the expansion is something we'll touch on. This book is like a lot of post-war science fiction in that it's not really so much about technology intersecting with people's lives as it is about sort of big concept issues. And so one of the things that I think may not come across as we talk about the plot here is how very fabular this writing is. There's no attempt to make this realistic. The dialogue is kind of stilted, but that's kind of suited to a story which is about ideas. It starts out with the introduction of our main character, Guy Montag, who is a fireman in this unspecified era of dystopian future. And in that case, it means that you burn things rather than that you put out fires. Specifically, you burn books and the property of people who own books because books have been outlawed. It starts out saying how much pleasure he derives from watching things burn and how happy it makes him to clean the world. We see him coming home from work, and he runs into this character, Clarice McClellan, who is a teenage girl and is something of a manic pixie dream girl before there were manic pixie dream girls. She engages Montag in a discussion about how beautiful nature is and how strange the world is and how she doesn't have time for the kind of schooling she's getting, and she loves things that are, I don't know, beautiful and natural, and that makes her special in some way. You're giggling.
I was going to use the phrase manic pixie dream girl if you didn't get to it.
Did I scoop you? I'm sorry. So you want to talk about this conversation? I mean, this conversation sort of sets the tone for the book, the way that this is a book full of conversations.
I mean, I think that label of her is really deserved because she is really just a plot device to kick things off. In fact, she's, like, a spoiler alert, she dies fairly early in the plot off screen. And that sets her up to just sort of simply be this propulsive force that causes the hero, of course, a man, to change his thinking. And then once she's served her purpose, she's kind of discarded with. And that was a bit of a surprise to me from having seen the film where she persists.
Right.
And one of the things that was in the end notes in the edition I read was a quote from Bradbury saying that that was one of the changes in the film that he thought was an improvement. And I guess he did a subsequent, he turned this into a play, and in his drama version, he actually retained the character longer.
I am of two minds of that. I mean, I did see the movie too, and we'll talk about the movie maybe after we finish with the book. It is interesting because the character in the movie is played as a young school teacher in her 20s, and that takes away some of the ookiness of the fact that Claire in the book is a 16-year-old that just shows up out of nowhere and starts engaging him, and he obviously develops some sort of a romantic fixation upon. And there is this thing that, as you say, that we'll get to, she disappears, and we're only told what happens to her as hearsay by another character that she died in a car accident. And I feel that that is a weird thing, and I would be more upset about it if I thought that Bradbury's male characters were any better, but I think everyone in this book is kind of a cipher.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one thing that I do kind of like about the fact that Claire just sort of disappears is it does strike me as very dreamlike. I mean, in dreams, characters appear and objects appear and then they disappear and you never get them back. And it doesn't quite follow the rules of sense of what a plot is. I think this book doesn't really follow a normal plotting And that's one thing that I think is actually in its favor for me, because I was kind of surprised by that. Meeting Clarice McClellan, in her description of how much she loves nature and the natural world, and how antisocial she is because she will not take part in the sanctioned school activities of watching lots and lots of television, and how she likes to walk places, which is apparently unheard of in this dystopian future, we kind of get to see what this society is like by comparing it to her behavior that is seen as eccentric. And we also get to see, as you say, Montag has this sudden stirring of conscience where he thinks maybe there's something more to life than just burning books. He goes home and he runs into his wife, Mildred, who, when we first meet her, is asleep, and it turns out that she has overdosed on sleeping pills. And Montag calls the EMTs, or what passes for EMTs in this future, which is basically sort of glorified technicians coming and bringing in a robotic medical device that pumps her stomach and replaces all of her blood. Again, this would seem to kind of mark this as science fiction, but there's no attempt at explaining any of what's going on here, or making it, you know, this has nothing to do with what we know about medicine. I mean, I just came from a platelet donation where they literally did take all of the blood out of my body and put it through a centrifuge and reintroduce it into my body. That took 2.5 hours, so I don't think that this is really likely.
That whole scene felt very Terry Gilliam in Brazil to me. I could just sort of imagine these sort of buff, careless guys just muscling in with very strange looking equipment and hooking it up, and then just kind of like waltzing off stage, having done their job in this very kind of matter of fact, but also horrifying way.
His wife survives. His wife, Mildred, survives. When she's conscious again, she has a conversation with Montag talking about how they need another television. It turns out that three of the walls in their house are televisions, and she wants all four of them to be televisions. As with all novels about the future that were written in the past, it's always kind of amusing to see where they see technology coming. The description of television and how much the television is going to cost and how it's going to be like half his salary that year is kind of amusing. He keeps seeing Clarice over the course of several days, and she tells him more stuff about moons and rainbows and stuff, and then she suddenly disappears. And there is a scene at work now where we get to see him with his fellow firemen at the firehouse, and there's a lot of kind of that 50s sci-fi expositionary dialogue where everyone's talking about what they're doing and how they do it and the technology they use to do it. We are introduced to the Electronic Hound, which is this giant robotic dog with 8 legs.
I had a very hard time picturing this thing in my head, and it's supposed to be terrifying, and you know, plays a very central role later on, but it seemed very out of place in what is otherwise a kind of future world, which is his Bradbury's present with just a few tweaks. Now, yes, big televisions, and he rides a monorail to work, and the fireman pole goes up as well as down. And then just out of nowhere, there's this one giant sort of monster robot. And I felt like the action stopped every time he tries to explain how this thing works.
Bradbury has this poetic inclination. He's trying to write things that are moody and dreamlike. And so he has this robot behave in sort of unpredictable ways. There seems to be a menace. The robot doesn't seem to like Montag for some reason, and all of the firemen are talking about a firefighter who committed suicide by having his electronic hound turn on him, and we're told that these hounds can sniff out your chemical composition somehow, and so they're supposed to sniff and breathe. But as you say, it's very hard to picture this. I guess I pictured it as one of those, you know, those videos you see on YouTube of those animal type robots that they have tromping around over someone's backyard somewhere that are like big camels or whatever.
Big dog.
It looks exactly like Big Dog, but only with that with eight legs or something. It's sort of like reading H.P. Lovecraft, and we're just told this thing is horrible, and we're left to decide what that means for ourselves. Anyway, this electronic hound is used by the firemen to sniff out potential book owners, I guess, and aid them in their quest to burn books. We have a scene where the firemen go on a call because there was reported an old woman with books hidden in her attic. And when they get there, they douse all the books with kerosene, but Montag grabs one. It says something like he falls into his hand, but it's not quite clear what's happening here, whether it was an accident or whether it was volition. I don't know. Montag grabs a book. The firemen are only supposed to destroy the books and the property, and they try to shoo the old woman out of her house. She refuses to leave and instead lights a match and immolates herself and the house. This is a scene I think that was done pretty well in the movie. If I remember, that was like one of the major set pieces in the movie. And yes. I think it's a beautiful and I'll complain a lot about Bradbury, but I think that this scene worked pretty well.
I agree.
And Montag, you know, is very shook up by this. He doesn't know what he thinks. He's got the book secreted on him. He goes home and he hides it in his under his pillow.
I agree. It was very effective. I think it takes place later in the movie, and it's more like at the halfway point of the film instead of the beginning. And I think it makes sense as it's put in the book, as it's hard to believe that this is the only time that had ever happened to him, but as a device to push him further over the edge, I think it was quite effective.
Montag starts really falling out with his wife, Mildred. He has conversations with her and about Clarice, and she tells him that she thinks Clarice died in a car accident, and they are there's just this kind of a sense he gets that he doesn't understand why he's with this woman or what she wants. She seems to be fixated only on getting more televisions.
She has no memory of, or claims to have no memory of, her suicide attempt, which I also thought was interesting.
Right. Well, it's an interesting point because for her to have attempted suicide implies a similar inner turmoil. It would be, you kind of keep waiting as a reader for that to come out, what that is. But instead, it seems like she ends up being an exemplar of the kind of shallow and uninteresting person that populates this dystopian future. I kind of feel like it's sort of a little unfair to the character, but, you know, again, a lot of these characters kind of stand in as sort of types and ideals. That's certainly true of Montag's boss. That's true of her. That's true of Clarice. It's true of Montag to a certain extent, really. I mean, Montag has very little that motivates him other than that he suddenly starts to wonder whether or not books might have any value. So after this event with a old woman killing herself, Montag stays home from work. He's feeling sick. His boss, Captain Beatty, comes to visit him to see how he's doing. And now we have one of these kinds of information dumps that happens in 50s science fiction, where Beatty just kind of expounds on the true history of firefighters up till now, or firemen. I mean, up till now, we've been told that everybody takes it as a matter of faith that firemen have always been charged with starting fires. And instead, Beatty starts talking about how over time, do you want to take this? This is a kind of a confusing thing, and I want to have some help on this. The reason why people burn books in the future.
I didn't know I was going to get quizzed. I guess I should have known it was a reading assignment.
Yeah.
I found the scene really hard to follow. I think because it was so unexpected to have this character talk like this. Everyone else is so elliptical, and then you have this character just, like you said, info dumping, but also in a literate way. I mean, you immediately realize that he is well read, but is also kind of crazy. And I was trying to understand in this scene why. I guess I wasn't expecting simply not showing up to work would cause this kind of reaction, and was still at this point, I think, trying to view Beatty as a human and not as almost the narrator of the world, which he serves as. He's the only character, at least at this point, who seems to have any understanding of the events that actually have past to create the world that we're in right now.
Right. It's an interesting thing because Beatty does talk with absolute clarity about the way in which people became uninterested in books because of the debased nature of mass media that was fast-paced and violent and simplified. But also, the thing that I found really interesting was he spent a lot of time saying the big problem with books are they don't agree with each other, and people took umbrage with one book or another. And he said minorities particularly take issue with the ideas in books. And you have cat lovers and you have dog lovers, and the cat lovers write one thing, the dog lovers write another thing. But you know that when he's talking about this, he's talking about other kinds of ethnicities and groups. And it's a strange kind of, it's a strange motivator for this prohibition on books. The idea that since books espouse different political viewpoints or different religious viewpoints or different aesthetic viewpoints, they create strife in the world, and we don't want strife in the world. It's an interesting thing to me because Fahrenheit 451 often gets cited as a book about the dangers of government control of media, and there it's usually pointed to as censorship of ideology. But in this case, it sounds a lot more to me like the kind of reactionary concerns people have about whether or not discourse is too PC these days. You know, it's like the Reddit crowd complaining about social justice warriors and everyone getting upset about things, and that's why books are bad.
One of the highlights that I had made, and I think this was Beatty, it's not in context, thank you, Kindle. If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none.
Right, right, exactly.
Which is that like end point of, discourse being a thing that we admire and at least used to teach, to realizing that it causes people a lot of unhappiness, and that therefore the purpose of society is to maximize contentment. But you're right in that I kind of expected it to be a much more 1984-ish top-down controlling universe, and it's much more of a Brave New World kind of anesthetized, almost self-imposed censorship, you know, not from any particular kind of idea, but just from ideas in general.
I want to touch on one thing that I think is really interesting, which you pointed out, is that Beatty is making all kinds of literary references as he talks. And throughout this book, there are a lot of literary references that assume the reader understands what's being referenced. And those references tend to be towards classical sources. I think Marcus Aurelius gets mentioned like a half dozen times in this book, to the Bible, to Shakespeare. Later, there's a quote of a Matthew Arnold poem. And there's an interesting thing here, which is this is supposed to be a world in which there are no books, and the people here seem to be more versed in literature than anyone I know, but also versed in a very specific kind of 1950s great books approach. You know, that old Harvard wall of great books that they used to have in libraries. And I think there's something going on here. I suspect it has a lot to do with Bradbury's own intellectual development, because Bradbury, as I mentioned, did not go to college, but he did read a lot. And he famously said, you know, I don't think that writers should go to school because I don't think it teaches you to be a good writer, that he thinks that reading teaches you to be a good writer. And you get this feeling from this book that here's a guy who really tried hard to teach himself everything he thought he should know, but he did it in a very kind of, you know, send away for this library of great books sort of manner. Because, you know, there's not a lot of discussion of anything past the 19th century in this book.
I certainly did not get most of the references, although it didn't matter all that much, but I was quite aware that my classical education was somewhat deficient.
Beatty tells Montag that all firemen eventually start to wonder about what's in these books that they're burning. He says that it's okay for him to hold on to any books that he may have picked up. He's being very coy about it and saying if someone did pick up a book, he could hold on to it for 24 hours as long as he turned it back in afterwards. It's you know, it all sounds like he's just making this up as he goes along, but he also is making it sound as though this is some sort of official policy.
A wink and a nudge, at least.
Leaving Montag alone, Montag grabs Mildred and says, "We've got to read these books." And it also turns out that now he doesn't just have this one book. He's got a few other books that he's hidden away over the course of his career.
I thought that was a nice reveal. I think the books sort of tumble out, or there's a big pile of them. And I guess that does suggest that he did deliberately pick up the one in the earlier scene.
Right.
Rather than it just... Or he had been unconsciously sort of collecting them for quite some time.
He and Mildred sit down and decide they're going to read this pile of books kind of out of context to find out if there's anything to this reading thing. And I just find it so hilarious, the idea of anyone picking up any six random books from, you know, Western history and reading them, and that being any kind of an experience that they could make sense of.
Well, and they're not like they're fun novels either. They're, you know, I think one of them is the Bible, and it's just opening randomly to some sort of classic of literature is not really going to sell you on reading out of the gate.
Montag himself seems very moved by reading the Bible, which is, again, I cannot imagine anyone without any kind of history of religious background or any kind of contextualization for this having any sensible reaction to the books of the Bible. But he's very... very stirred by this. I wouldn't say he's necessarily converted into a reader, but he's very interested in this idea of ideas and conflict. And his wife is having none of it. She just wants to go back to watching television. There's like a couple of small matters in here, like while they're reading the books, they hear a sniffing outside. Montag thinks it might be the hound, but it's just a dog. They have all these kinds of arguments about the books. And what happens is because Mildred isn't interested in exploring this any further with him, Montag remembers a ex-literature professor that he met a year ago in the park that he's going to call up. And, you know, again, this is kind of this weird thing that Bradbury is doing, is sort of like he's kind of going back and amending the story and introducing these things that we don't know about Montag in a backwards fashion. And it's not a bad move, but it is kind of playing with what we have established already. It's sort of like up till now we've been kind of led to believe that Montag had this sudden change of heart, but it turns out that he's been mulling these ideas over for a while now. He calls up this guy Faber, and that's the other thing that I kind of can't decide what I think about that. Faber, of course, to me sounds like Faber and Faber, the British publishing company.
Yes.
Montag is a paper production company, and there's kind of that easy sort of meaningless symbolism, I think, in this book sometimes. Faber won't talk on the phone, but Montag goes to visit Faber, and Faber talks at length about books, and we have another kind of long series of monologues in here, and Faber tries to explain what is good and true about reading.
The books are to remind us what asses and fools we are. They're Caesar's Praetorian Guard, whispering as the parade roars down the avenue, "Remember, Caesar, thou art mortal." Most of us can't rush around, talking to everyone, know all the cities of the world. We haven't the time, money, or that many friends. The things you're looking for, Montag, are in the world, but the only way the average chap will ever see 99% of them is in a book. Don't ask for guarantees, and don't look to be saved in any one thing, person, machine, or library. Do your own bit of saving, and if you drown, at least die knowing you were headed for shore.
I had to look up the Praetorian Guard reference, again, my classical education being poor. So apparently it is... it was customary, or at least it is believed to have been customary, that there were guards, slaves typically, constantly marching with Roman emperors when they were at their height of parading around their military victories to remind them of mortality. And that segues into into what felt a little bit unrelated, of the idea that books give us an experience of the whole world that we couldn't possibly get on our own time and with our own reach. I guess today we would substitute the internet.
Bradbury, he's got a poetic heart, but he kind of has a hard time staying on message. And I do think that maybe that's realistic enough. I mean, if someone asked you what you thought the value of reading or literature is, I think, you know, your mind would race around and you'd be grasping at this and that and the other thing, and they may not all be related. I mean, the idea of literature as a sort of a memento mori is one thing. The idea of literature as this connection we have to people and places that are beyond our grasp is another. The idea of ideas being in conflict with one another, and that being, and it only being through that sort of dialogue that we reach anything approximating truth, is a third thing. And I think that those all may be related in some way. I don't think that this quote relates them, but I do think it is a good example of the way that Bradbury writes. And if you like that kind of thing, you like this book. You know, I think that the people who like Bradbury love his ambition in writing these kinds of big ideas, whether or not he actually ends up saying anything or not.
I can certainly see relating the, so that sense that that literature is meant to knock you off your pedestal does feel related to the thing we were talking about earlier about the reason to ban books was to get rid of disagreement because they represented different viewpoints. And so if you limit disagreement, you limit the possibility that you were wrong. And I can see a interesting argument to say that it is an important part of the human condition to be reminded that we don't know everything, that there are other schools of thought, that we are, even in our greatest moments, likely to be fools or to simply drop dead. But I had to go and think about that passage for a while and look up the reference to actually sort of draw that line.
They spent a long time going back and forth about these things. Montag wants Faber to help him in a kind of a spur. In the spur of the moment, Montag decides he wants to become a revolutionary. He doesn't really have a clear idea of what this revolution would be, other than he wants to make copies of the books that he has, and particularly the Bible, which he suspects he may have the last copy of the Bible in existence. So he wants to secure Faber's aid in this. Faber introduces this little earpiece radio that he puts into Montag's ear, saying that he'll be able to keep in touch with him in this way. And it's kind of a hilarious thing because it reminds me of, I recently read, several years ago when my kids were younger, I read the Three Investigators books to them. And one of the things that they make a big deal out of is the fact that these kids had walkie-talkies and how exciting that was. And it's sort of like that here. So like, we have a radio that we will put in your ear that no one can see, you know, this idea that there's something magical about that. Although it's not clear where Faber is getting this technology from.
And it's such a transparent plot device. It's actually believable as particularly 21st century technology. You know, we're connected all the time. Of course, you could imagine having a constant dialogue with someone. But in the book, it is incredibly artificial. You know, he just happens to have this thing lying around that he invented basically for the purpose of the subsequent scenes.
He goes home. I mean, Montag goes back home, and we have the scene where he walks in on Mildred throwing a party with a couple of her friends watching the parlor walls, the televisions which make up their walls, and there's kind of a dig at the insipidness of popular culture, particularly television. It's interesting, you know, because Bradbury wrote for television. He wrote for the movies. He was not anti-movies or television, but here he just kind of is against the kind of meaningless and simplified drama of the day. And he tells the women there that he tries to make this case that they should be doing something better with their time. He turns off the sets and he reads a poem from the Book of Poems that he has. And the poem he chooses is Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold, which is not mentioned by name or by author in the text of Fahrenheit 451. But he reads a stanza from this, and it makes one of the women break down crying from her reaction to it. All I can think is, if I had to pick a poem to try and convince someone else of the value of poetry or to move them, I sure as hell would not pick Matthew Arnold. That is.
What if it was literally the last poem on earth?
Well, I guess, you know, but he said it was from a collection of poems. I mean, couldn't he have, okay, like,
fair.
He could have started with A Purple Cow or something like that. This is, you know, Matthew Arnold is a very dense Victorian poet that English professors disagree about what Dover Beach means. It's a poem that's kind of broadly speaking about the dissolution of faith in the modern world and the need for people to replace that with some sort of faith towards each other. It's hard to pull apart, and it's a, you know, I am not sure, having read it myself, what the poem ultimately is about. And I certainly don't find it necessarily that it elicits strong emotion from people. It's a very intellectual poem.
Obviously, in this world, everyone is supposed to be consumed by this. They just refer to it as the family, the kind of endless television series, seemingly modeled after a soap opera that everyone's watching. It did bother me that we only ever see women watching it, which is exemplified in this scene. All the male characters, you know, either have very little dialogue, like the other firemen, or are actually well-read, regardless of whether that necessarily makes sense for their characters. So the whole scene felt a little spiteful to me. All of these women are so ridiculous, and their reactions are nonsensical. I wish that there were at least some sense of what this world had, what they found compelling about the world that they live in. I mean, there's no opportunity for them to have any kind of sort of inner voice. They're just complete caricatures. And at the same time, the show that they're watching, I kept thinking the entire time was like Waiting for Godot. Like, they're watching the most existentialist, like minimalist play imaginable. I mean, it's not even, there's no narrative. It's just this kind of like fragmented dialogue that I actually thought was really interesting. And yet, you know, is meant to represent the most sort of vapid form of entertainment.
Montag does return to the firehouse the next day with the Bible. He hides all his other books, and he hands it over, and it's tossed out, and Beatty has this strange conversation where he talks about a dream that he had, that he and Montag were fighting endlessly by quoting each other. Beatty is, you know, admits that he had once been an enthusiastic reader, which comes as no surprise. There is a fire alarm that goes off, and which is, of course, to let them know that someone has books and they have to go burn their place down. And they go out on this call, and when they come to the site, it's Montag's own home. Apparently, his wife reported him, and Beatty tells Montag he has to destroy his house. There's a scene where Montag tries to engage Mildred, but she leaves in a taxi. Montag goes ahead and does burn his house down with a flamethrower piece by piece. And then there's like this scene where Beatty discovers that Montag has this earpiece in his, and one of the things that I kind of laughed about that was nothing really happened with this device other than it implicated Faber, which, I actually kind of liked, because you were kind of expecting it to be set up that there was going to be some major sequence with this.
Mm-hmm.
Because Beatty is threatening to find Faber, Montag actually turns his flamethrower on to Beatty and burns him up. He also is able to knock out his coworkers. I guess, you know, I that seemed kind of unrealistic to me. It sort of seemed more like Bradbury just needed to get him out of the scene somehow. I never got the feeling that Montag was much of a bruiser.
I got the impression that Beatty, I mean, that this was just sort of suicide by someone else's hand. Beatty's just clearly taunting a person with a flamethrower, and I think he would have sense to not do that if he were actually interested in preserving his own skin.
As Montauk is fleeing, he's attacked by the mechanical hound, who is able to the mechanical hound has hypodermics on its legs and is able to inject one of Montauk's legs with a tranquilizer, and Montauk turns the flamethrower on the hound, is able to get away, but he's kind of limping away. He runs to Faber's house, and Faber makes another big reveal that there's this, that he knows of a enclave of exiled book lovers that live outside in the country. He tells Montauk he should go out there and they'll meet up with him later. Somewhere in here, Montauk also gives Faber some sort of way of covering up his scent so that the hound won't trace him to Faber's house. There's a lot of this kind of like hand wavy, like this changes your scent, this, you know, will confuse the hound or whatever. Because I don't think Bradbury has any real interest in technology beyond the sort of the big ideas he has here. He is able to escape wading into a river to throw off. Montauk is able to escape wading into a river. I'm sorry if I'm going through this all. This part, I have to say, towards the end of the book, I was kind of having a hard time picturing things. It seemed like the writing was less vivid to me somehow, or maybe I was just reading it late at night and falling asleep reading it.
There's the bit where he breaks into the other firemen's houses
and
plants books. I think that's before he goes into the river.
Right.
Because I think he pops out of the river and then he's in hobo land.
Right. Yeah, he does this last bit of sabotage before he goes out of the town. And once he gets out of the river in the countryside, he does come to this hobo land full of these people who are, what do they call themselves? They call themselves living books or something like that.
I think they say that in the movie. I'm actually not sure what they call them. I don't remember them having a label in the
right
book.
Well, in any case, this little town of book hobos is led by a guy named Granger, and they each are tasked with the memorization of a specific book. Now, this is one of the things that really I had to read this like three or four times to actually believe that this was what Bradbury meant to say. But he says that it doesn't matter if you can't remember the book. If you've read a book once in your life, there is a technique that they know that will allow you to recall that book. And they don't say what that technique is, whether that involves hypnosis or therapy or medicine or technology of any kind, but there's some sort of magical way that allows them to extract books from people's minds on one reading, and which, you know, raises all kinds of questions in my mind. Like, what happens if you skipped over a few words here or there? What happens if you didn't understand the book when you read it the first time, or these sorts of things? Because in the movie, I think there's actually a much more affecting scene at the end where it turns out that these people memorize the books. They learn them by heart. And there's this beautiful sequence of these people walking around and reciting these books aloud. And you get to kind of hear these great books being read aloud. And it makes it much more, I think, important and precious. And you also are struck by how precarious this all is. Kind of also reminds me of there's a Islamic tradition of people memorizing the Quran, and that's considered to be a great blessing to be able to do that, and how important that book would be to someone if you actually had to memorize it by heart. I think this kind of it bothered me. It really bugged me.
There's also this we haven't mentioned it at all because it's a kind of such a strange aside, but there in the background of all of this, there's a world war going on.
Right. Yes.
And for the longest time in the narrative, it's referenced repeatedly about the war and the war's about to start. And I just kept thinking of it as a 1984-ish, oh, this is a sort of a sham war that's just there to distract the populace and keep them, you know, sedated. But in fact, it's an actual war that then happens, and that I think, and I'm pretty sure this entire subplot is missing from the film, and this, it really undercuts this scene where, as you say, it's intensely important. It would be great if they actually were doing the hard work of memorizing it. It's kind of lame that that's sort of waved away. And even the central importance of these characters who have memorized these books is almost an aside, because meanwhile, like, Chicago or whatever the big city is that they're near is about to be annihilated.
Right after Montag is charged with being the Book of Ecclesiastes because he's read the Bible, as you say, there are these bombers that come overhead and destroy this city that he's just escaped from, presumably destroying his wife as well, and all the people there. And the the book hobos kind of say, "Oh well, time to rebuild everything," and that's sort of the note that the book ends on, that these now armed with the great works of Western literature, they're going to go back into the charred remains of the city and rebuild everything. And that's where the book ends.
I did like, there's a lot of description of, as he's on the run, of him sort of popping in and out of, and it was sort of like looking at TVs and bars as he goes along, seeing the faked chase of the hound actually just getting reassigned to some like poor schmo, and sort of watching himself and watching other people watch this chase in real time, that did feel like kind of nicely prescient, you know, the just how we now react to really any sort of trivial news event that happens in real time. I actually thought that was quite cool, and did build a certain amount of tension in this scene, but like, it's all so strange because it really doesn't matter because the whole city is just about to be bombed. It's like, I don't want to nitpick a book that's meant to not hang together logically, but it really does undercut a lot of the whole sort of point of his whole journey when everyone's just about to die anyway. And it seems like everyone knows that the war is about to start. It kind of goes as planned. But I guess it's okay because he memorized one book of the Bible.
Well, it's a strange thing about, I think, the overall tone of this book, which is it does take place in this kind of a fantasy world in which everybody can discuss Marcus Aurelius and everybody is interested in having lengthy discussions about the value of literature or what have you. And nobody seems to actually be engaged in the actual process of living their lives, you know, one way or another. They're either engaged in these great aesthetic or existential questions, or they are completely absorbed by the entertainments of the world around them. And it's unclear to me whether or not at the end of the book, when this war finally takes its toll and destroys the city, whether we're supposed to just kind of see that as, okay, here's an end to the story, or whether was Bradbury's point all along that these people are so distracted by this vapid culture that they had no concern for their own safety or for what was actually mattering in their lives at that moment. I don't know. It Bradbury is an author who I always feel is like on the verge of being a good author. Like, there's a lot of interesting little ideas here and there, but when something like this happens at the end of the book and it just kind of comes out at the end, I don't know to what extent that was Bradbury's plan all along, or whether that's just kind of like, I needed to end the book somehow.
I mean, as you said, it was a short story blown out, and I think I don't have a paper version, but my guess was that it's barely over 100 pages.
Yeah, it is very short.
It feels like it is both too long and too short. Like, it's too it's too long to be a very clear, just story of ideas. So he has to put some of this world building background in it, but it's not nearly enough to feel like an actual world. And it has a lot of internal inconsistencies that I tried not to let bother me, but sometimes really do. Like, the book hobos are all ex-professors and of like literature. And it's hard to reconcile that with what must be the timeline, which is that someone like Montag, who is presumably an adult, like, if these people are professors, then the world must have been not that different within his own lifetime. Yet you get the sense that it has been like this for some unknown eternity.
Right. And again, that could be a point that Bradbury is trying to make about the shortness of the popular imagination or the popular memory, but you can't tell whether that's really the case. You know, it's sort of like with Star Wars, when we have the time between the Old Republic and what happens in the original Star Wars is really only like 40 years, but it's played up like it's hundreds and hundreds of years.
Wow, you have outgeeked me.
Sorry. Anyway, let's a couple of things. I was going to talk a little bit about the movie. We've actually covered almost everything I was going to bring up, but I did want to mention one strange thing about this movie. This movie was by Francois Truffaut, and it was his only English language movie and that he directed. And in the movie, Clarice and Mildred were both played by Julie Christie, which is a very strange thing. And it's been a long time since I've seen the movie. I never got what the point was of that double casting. Usually when people do double casting, it's to try and draw some sort of a parallel between characters. But there is no real parallel between these two characters.
I can see it as a... Since both women are props, as are most of the characters, I can see almost doubling down on that to make it... It makes it actually somewhat less offensive if they're just so clearly non-representational. But the wife character, she has a different name in the movie, it's not like she's the other side of the argument, because I think neither in the film does she get a real voice in saying why this world is at least for her better than the alternative. She just is a placid recipient of the world, and then there's Manic Pixie Dream Girl. And I don't remember, it has also been a while since I've seen the film, but I don't think Julie Christie plays it that same way. Clarice does not actually talk very much about books. The book stuff doesn't occur until later. She's much more interested in, you know, her free-spirited, like free-roaming child kind of viewpoint, which I actually think is sort of more interesting. It's not just that this, like, in the best part of the movie is actually the intro credits, because there are no words. It's all spoken. And there's some scenes in the film where you see people like on the subway reading, you know, instead of newspapers, they're reading comics, the wordless comics. And there's a different sense in the film that like reading has been banned, and that's clearly not true in the book. And I think in the film, although it gives it a kind of tighter clarity, it takes away from Bradbury's larger point, which is not so much that this is the society is bad because they don't read. The society is bad because they are completely turned inward and, you know, don't, like, I was surprised that his wife had friends at all. It seemed like she just would spend all of her time indoors with her fake family.
But if I recall, one of little we do learn about her friends are things like that one of them has a husband who died horribly in some sort of accident or something like this. And there's like all this personal tragedy that they've gone through, and they have no depth to their character that you would associate with having had bad lives. They still seem to be able to skirt along life on the surface. One other thing about movies while we're on the subject, one thing that always bugged me a lot about this was, if you recall, Michael Moore made that movie Fahrenheit 9/11 about the Bush administration, and the way that it changed policy after 9/11 and the way that people kind of gave them a blank check to do whatever they wanted to because of the tragedy of 9/11. And at the time, Bradbury made a huge stink about Moore using the Fahrenheit
brand.
He was on like Fox or something saying, the quote is something about like, he's putting my title on his film. I had nothing to do with this film. Therefore he can't take credit. And I always thought this is a guy who wrote a novel called Something Wicked This Way Comes, a short story called There Will Come Soft Rains, and another story called I Sing the Body Electric. And I always thought, here's a guy, you know, who has no self-awareness about this at all, if that's the way that he's going to approach this. I mean, it's also interesting to me that he went on to say in the same interview, one of the reasons why he was angry about this was he said, my novel is not a political novel. It is an aesthetic novel, a philosophical and a sociological study in modern history. It's not political at all in any way, yet a study of humanity and education. And that division that he draws, that strong division between something being political and being aesthetic or philosophical, I mean, speaks a lot to the way that he thinks about this book and the way that he approaches this book, because I don't see how you can not see this book as having political implications one way or another, whether or not they are clear, whether or not he had them in mind. You know, you're doing a book about a centralized government controlling the media and actively punishing outside expressions of that. That's a political statement.
Yeah, even if he believed it, the premise sets up that the public essentially did this to themselves. But nevertheless, by the time the events of the novel happen, this is a very centralized, systematized method of maintaining the status quo, which is obviously political.
Now, I touched on this really briefly at the beginning of the podcast, but I would like to also point out at the end of this that Bradbury is an interesting author in his sort of place vis-a-vis serious literature. And I wish I could put scare quotes around my serious here, you know, about literary fiction. I always feel when I listen to interviews with him or read them that he always felt like he wanted to be an insider in the world of serious fiction, and that he always felt kind of marginalized by being seen as just a science fiction writer. And I see a lot of parallels between his writing and that of Kurt Vonnegut. Both of them started out writing science fiction. Vonnegut became the darling of the literary world, and he today is seen as a important American writer. Bradbury, his claim to fame is a little less, and I think is largely predicated on this one book, which partly because it does get taught a lot in schools, and it is seen as this kind of a watershed novel about censorship, and came out, you know, just at the time of McCarthyism, so it can't help but be associated with that.
Well, I mean, Vonnegut certainly wrote more notable works. You know, if he had written just one, I'm sure there are quite a number of them that could have made him a darling in and of itself. But I mean, he has many classic novels, not just one. I'm trying not to say something totally obvious, like, well, he's just a better writer. He's funnier, so he's much more approachable. I mean, he has that, like we talked earlier, that there is that kind of black comic scene of his wife's stomach getting pumped, but that's really the only moment where we see any kind of sense of satire. You can enjoy Vonnegut just for the prose, for the humanity of it. This is, as we've said, a novel of ideas. It is not populated by humans. I can't remember enough of Bradbury's other work, but I think just on the strength of is it both ideas and people? He falls down a bit.
What do you think about this book as a book for high schoolers? Why do you think this book does get taught in high schools, or do you think it should be taught in high schools?
I mean, obviously the ideas are important and interesting. I don't know that I would pick this one over other dystopian novels. I think, I mean, if you're going to teach one, it seems obvious you should teach 1984, if only for the cultural references that are just sort of permeate it. It's not a fantastic example of great writing. It does feel, certainly the, like, you know, background of nuclear atomic bombs feels dated and not in an interesting way. So you never want to say, I don't think Fahrenheit 451 should be taught in schools, because then it makes you sound like a censor. But I think if you're going to try to teach something about censorship or about totalitarian societies, this I wouldn't pick this one first.
Thanks once again to my guest, Liza Daly, whose projects and writings are online at lizadaly.com. Thanks for this show's reading. Go to Shannon Camp, whose website is at shannon-camp, with an E on the end, .com. The excerpt from Bach's Goldberg Variations is by Kikimo Ishizaka and is available under the Creative Commons license at freemusicarchives.org. Fahrenheit 451 is copyright 1953 Ray Bradbury. Thanks for listening, and remember, everything will be on the final.